nicest car.
He's the most honest car you've ever seen.
It's been a dream ever since I've had it.
The first time I heard that engine screaming, I thought, I gotta have one of those.
For me, the cars have personality.
What's great about a BMW Classic is the community that surrounds it.
When you listen to that, that's why we're here.
Welcome to our very first episode of Classic Heart, the BMW Group Classic Podcast. My name is JP Ruskin, and today we have Anders Billet in the studio. He spent his childhood in a BMW dealership, used his job as a professional pilot to source classic cars worldwide, became director of one of the most incredible car museums in the world, and today he's working as a car specialist for RM Sotheby's. He really has stories to tell, and I'm quite excited to listen to them. So, Anders, where do we find you today?
Philip, I'm sat very comfy in my home office, just a bit southwest of Copenhagen in Denmark.
Fantastic. And, you know, is it true that they say that Danish people are the most happiest people in the world?
Well, I try to do my part anyway to keep it up. I think we are generally quite happy. Good lifestyle. We're happy here.
And that also without Faxe and Carlsberg.
Well, yeah, Carlsberg tastes better in Denmark than it does outside of Denmark.
That's so true. I heard a lot about this. So that's actually like, you're a bit like the French who kept the best Oilers for them and then for export is the second class.
Absolutely. Makes sense to do that, doesn't it?
I couldn't agree more. I tell you what, I hope that BMW does not the same.
I think I've got a few good ones here in Denmark, so I've been okay. I've been all right on that one.
For all those who are listening in today and are not speaking Danish as I don't, but what I find out is that actually your name has already given by birth your passion for cars, because Biel, let's say like Billet is your full name and Biel is the Danish word for car, isn't it?
That is true. The boring truth is that my surname is actually older than the invention of the automobile.
Anders, but when did this love for cars start? What are your first memories?
My first drive in a car, just a few days old, was in the back seat of my parents' 1972 Chamonix white BMW 2000 TII Touring. Now, obviously, I can't claim that I remember that, but did it start already then? Possibly. My father was an avid car enthusiast as well, or is still an avid car enthusiast. And when I was only about 2 years old, him and his best friend, they bought a BMW and Honda dealership in the south of Denmark. So growing up with the car dealership and as a kid, you know, running around the workshop, the sales area, the parts department, looking at all the shelves with all the bits in, a fascinating place to grow up as a kid.
But was it the first encounter of your father to become a car dealer, or was there a tradition before that?
My father was a car enthusiast and BMW enthusiast, hence the, I mean, back then, BMW did not have the market share it does today. So while many BMW enthusiasts today are definitely proper BMW enthusiasts, there are also BMWs out there that are just driven as, you know, as company cars, transport. Back then, if you drove a BMW, it was a very, very conscious decision.
What an endeavor. I think pure passion.
Pure and passion. I think absolutely.
What we always say, and let's jump a little bit further into our conversation, what comes up, because you also made your enthusiasm and passion into a profession. So I see a tradition coming up there.
Yeah, I'm infected much more by the car bug than even my father was. I bought my first car age 16 and got into classic cars immediately. And initially, I ventured into car business.
Super interesting, but we will get back to that later. I have so many fond and happy memories about Denmark because the majority of my youth I spent not only on vacation, but also on weekends in an old watermill, which my parents owned at that time, which was quite difficult because owning for non-Danish people was a big deal and is today. But one of my earliest memory of the car culture in Denmark is that time you saw a Toyota Hilux driving down the road. All my Danish friends at that time say, oh, a luxury car, because they're so incredibly expensive. Is this still the case?
Very much so. I think we've got just about the highest prices on new cars worldwide. They have pretty hefty import taxes on them because we don't produce cars here ourselves. To be a car enthusiast in Denmark, that's an expensive hobby.
Does this also apply to vintage cars, or is there like an exemption?
It evens out more. It does even out more. I mean, with classic cars, it's more of an international market. There is still an import tax on a classic car, but it is much, much less than on new cars. So it's a bit easier as long as you stick to the old stuff.
Okay, so I think we could recommend that as well. Stick to the old stuff.
Absolutely.
Because that's very, like, also very lasting, I would say, in terms of joy and also environmental thinking. So when your father and his best mate bought the dealership, what year was this?
1978.
So were cars also like super expensive at that time still?
They were. So selling BMWs in Denmark in 78, it wasn't an easy thing. Mm-hmm. And it was a small dealership. You know, we weren't in the middle of Copenhagen, some big flashy dealership. It was a very, very small dealership out in the countryside. I know it was a struggle for them, but they loved their jobs and got to drive cool cars and play with cars every day of their life.
Yeah, get to the source. Always a good decision.
Absolutely.
Nowadays, dealerships are super like streamlined and super corporate. So you said that you were wandering around all the showroom and the garages. How did a BMW dealership in the late 1970s look like in Denmark?
Well, those two words, corporate and streamlined, they are probably the two most remote words from what it was. I remember a lot of brown, all shades of brown, but very brown. It was small. You know, it was a tiny little showroom. I think it was two, maybe three cars inside. And then they had a few cars stood outside. Behind that, really tight packed shelves with all the spares lined up. And at the back, there was the workshop, which, to be honest, oil and spare parts all over the place. It wasn't clean and slick as it has to be nowadays, but it had soul, it had charm. It was real, it was authentic, you know, it was like a workshop was back then.
I would like to learn more about your memories, because for me, that would be like the dream if my father would have a car dealership with a garage. So what stuck to your memory out of that when you were a kid?
One of the sort of standout memories was I was at home at that point. I remember my father coming home. This was a big deal, especially in Denmark where cars were so expensive. He came home with a brand new, it wasn't obviously his, it was a demonstrator that they had in the company, but a brand new Polaris Silver BMW 635 CSI, which had just been launched with the 3.5 liter engine.
Boah.
And he parked that on the drive, you know, and I just remember as a kid, even though it wasn't ours, the fact that that car was parked on our drive, I mean, it made a massive impression on me. I think I was the proudest kid in the whole neighborhood on that day. It was just fabulous.
Was it the one which already had on the left-hand side this little board computer stuff with all the little
yes.
bits and dots there? Oh,
yes,
I loved this.
It did.
It's so
brilliant.
So
you press the check button and it all light up
yes.
red. It was brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. That was out of this world. I remember when I flipped through car magazines, at my age then, vintage car magazines already, and saw this car considered at that time in the late 90s, a young timer.
Yeah.
That was really like, fantastic.
Very high tech.
Very high
for
tech.
For that age.
Yes. And I have to say, pretty emotional for a German car. Because at that time, German cars were not like that emotional. They were functional and super good.
Yeah.
But not emotional. There was this color called Salmon Silver, something like Lux Silver.
Lux Silver,
was
yeah.
Like a, you know, how Lux Silver, what a kind of car. I really like that. I really like that idea of having a fish skin.
Yeah.
So was it clear that your first car must be a BMW?
It had to be. I mean, my father always spoke about his O2s and it made an impression, of course, on a young kid like me. So I was in love with the O2. My first car had to be one. But it was difficult. It was a challenge because I ended up buying my first car in 92. And at that point, they weren't regarded the iconic BMW at that point. So the cars we went to look at, frankly, I mean, they were horrible. They were rust buckets. They were patched up. They were terrible. And finding a decent one was, we almost gave up.
And what was it then?
It's a 1973 Verona Red BMW 2002, just with the regular Solex carburetor, not the TII or anything. But
yeah.
One of the last ones with round rear lights, which to me was important. Back then anyway, I think they're a bit more iconic with those round rear lights. They stand out a bit more. And the funny thing is, it's been dealt, when it was sold in 73, it was sold through the dealership, which my father and his friend ended up buying in 78.
What a legacy.
I know, exactly. I mean, it was bound to be. And actually, the year they bought the dealership, it was sold privately to the second owner. And in 81, this second owner came into this the same BMW dealership and traded it in on a new BMW 3 Series, the 21. At which point the head mechanic in the workshop bought the car out of the dealership. And he then had the car as a third owner from 81 until 1992 when I bought it from him.
Fantastic.
It had to be mine. And then when I bought it in 92, it was a little bit tired as well, but it was honest at least. It had never been messed about.
Yeah.
The head mechanic then helped me restore the car as well. A two-year process, and we brought her back to her former glory and had her ready for when I got my driver's license aged 18 and... off I went.
Perfect.
Off I went in my little red BMW.
What a story. I really like that.
So many great colors, though, back then. The oranges, great greens, and it wasn't just a silver and black. There were real colors on the cars.
Yes. Amazonas green, Riviera.
Yeah.
Malaga, I think, was kind of brownish.
Yeah, yeah.
Atlantic, which was, I think, like a blue-grayish, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, very dark blue, sort of with grayish tones.
Yeah.
One of my favorites is Taiga Metallic, vivid green metallic.
It's more light.
It is. It is.
And did you do some modifications to make daily driving in your classic BMW easier?
Nope. We stuck with keeping it original. Many people, they upgrade with a 5-speed gearbox. Mine still has the 4-speed. If it was good enough in 73, it's good enough in 21.
Yeah. And do you think the car should be kept in super original condition?
Personally, I think it also depends what type of car we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're in the privileged situation of owning a Ferrari 250 GTO, I'm sorry, but you don't get to modify it. You should keep that as it was born.
Mm-hmm.
It's a slightly hyped term, but you are really a custodian then. If you've got something like a BMW 2002, which at the end of the day, they produced about 850,000 of them. So while there's obviously not that many left today, still it is a mass produced car. And I think it's more up to the owner. Whoever owns the car should do with that car what brings them the greatest pleasure. For me, that is keeping it, if not entirely original, then certainly very, very period correct, as you also mentioned. I think small period modifications are perfectly acceptable because it's, for me, it's not necessarily about how it left the factory. It's about creating a time capsule back to a different era.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, we do share one thing. We like classic cars.
Exactly.
So let's embrace that. Rather than fight about whether they should be original or not, or period or not, or, you know.
Absolutely. Let's come back to your car. What is your dearest memory with it?
She's no garage queen. I've put about 140,000 kilometers on her and traveled through 12 different European countries with it.
Mega.
I mean, German O2 Club have held this thing called the Bavaria Tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to 4 of them. Those drives were epic, just amazing. You know, 200 plus O2s along small country roads into the Alps. You know, it's behind the steering wheel. That's where the joy is. And also sharing it with my daughters. They love to come along. They're only 10 and 13, but they like to come along for a drive. And that's obviously a bit special as well, being able to hand it on. But of course, there's also the people you meet. I mean, the social aspect that you get out of being a classic car enthusiast is quite special as well. I mean, I mentioned the history of my car. The second owner who owned the car from 78 to 81, I met him by chance at a classic car meet.
Oh, really?
Around 95. I didn't know who he was, obviously, but there was an international BMW meet in Copenhagen that year. I think it was 95. I'm pretty sure it was.
Mm.
And we were parked on the main town square, if you will, in the middle of Copenhagen with all these classic BMs. And there were lots of beautiful cars there and people walking around looking at them, not just people taking part in the event, but spectators as well. One particular gentleman, he sort of stuck around. He kept walking around my car. It had been going on for quite a while, so I thought I'd approach him. And I asked, do you want to sit in it or something? Because he seemed really interested. He was very quiet. And he went, okay, he would like to do that. So I opened up the door and I was expecting him to sort of, you know, jump in and get comfortable behind the steering wheel, sort of get a feel of what it would be like to drive it. But instead, he flipped down the sun visor of the car and he pulled this tiny little pin from within the sun visor. And he sits there with this pin between his fingers and just smiles. And he goes, I knew it. I could recognize it. I knew it. And it was his car.
Unbelievable.
So when he bought the car in 78, he had put this pin there and he used it to clean the washers for their windscreen.
Yeah.
And he had left it up there and it was still there. So yeah.
What an amazing story.
It is cool. And he was there in an Isetta.
Ah, nice.
We stayed in touch and still now we see each other every so often and that's what 30 years of ownership brings you of a classic car. It's special drives and it's special relationships to cool people.
What a fantastic story. Yeah, what a fantastic story. Anders, you own quite a few cars, and I think it's fair, let's call it a collection. What else is in this collection?
Well, I am a BMW man at heart, so there's another 02 as well, a 2002, which I use for historic hill climbing. Must it be original? Well, this one clearly isn't, but it is modified entirely as you would have done in period. Then I've got a 74 BMW 3.0 S, the big E3, the predecessor to the 7 Series. And at the time, I didn't have the money to buy the car, so instead I convinced my mother to buy it. And of course, she basically never got to drive it because I kept the keys, and eventually the car was just, it just ended up being mine. So so those are my three BMs I have currently. I've had many more, but they're, you know, you can't keep them all. And then I've got a 78 Reliant Scimitar GTE.
Oh, brilliant.
Which is just a fabulous GT car, and bang for buck, it's amazing. I mean, they're worth nothing. Massively undervalued, in my opinion. So far from the best GT car out there, but in terms of what you pay, I would argue it's the best GT car bang for buck. I've got a 1965 Sunbeam Tiger, big American V8 engine shoehorned into a small two-seater British roadster.
My favorite concept, I have to say. You know, I'm a member of the V8 club, so I always like V8. So that is exactly down my alley. Yeah. I really like it. If they shuffle in this tiny little sprinting cars, they shuffle in these big American engines. I love that.
Exactly. It's good fun. It's very direct. It's brutal. It's analog. You can drive from A to B. And when you get to B, you don't really remember the drive. You don't know how you got there. That's not possible in a Sunbeam Tiger. You need to be there. You need to grab it and drive it and take control of it. It's just not going to work if you don't. But that's where the whole pleasure comes from. And then I'm also restoring a bit of a rarity, a 1963 Rochdale Olympic.
Nice.
A small British fiberglass car, sports car, which they built less than 400 of them. So it's quite a rarity, but they're pretty cool. Everybody knows the Lotus Elite, which was the first monocoque fiberglass car.
Yeah.
The Rochdale Olympic was the second monocoque fiberglass car. And of course, you never get a prize for second place, but I really like it. If you take the front half of a Porsche 356 and the rear of a Jaguar E-Type coupe and put the two together, then you shrink it a bit and sprinkle it with ugly dust. And ta-da, you've got a Rochdale Olympic. But it's very charming and it's good fun. So that's being restored at the moment. And I look forward to getting that back out on the road again. It hasn't driven since 78 or 9, I think it is. It was taken off the road. So a lot of work, but it'll be fun.
It's very strange that you mention exactly that car you're working on, because I do actually know the Rochdale Olympic. And it's a very strange story why I do know about this. Thanks to the Google algorithm, because you start searching for something completely different. And I remember that I was looking into Riley engines. And so there's the connection with the Rochdale Olympic. And you end up with finding a car you never heard of. And to be honest, which is quite interesting, because it has been built for a long, long time. I think they start in the 1950s. Until the 70s, they built the Olympic, and no one knows about this. So immediately the next morning, I called my colleague Alex in our UK office from Classic Driver, the youngest one in the team at that time. He must not be older than 22, if I remember correctly. And I asked, you know, Alex, I found this fantastic car. We need to do a story about it. It's called Rochdale Olympic. Do you happen to know this? And he said, of course I do. You can imagine how embarrassed I felt about this one. This young chap knows more about cars than I do. And so this is how I get in touch with this. And if I remember correctly as well, these Cooper-inspired wheels really caught my attention and I really loved them. And for those who would like to look this up while listening to us, it's Rochdale, spelled R-O-C-H-D-A-L-E, and then Olympic. And when you find the first photo, you definitely understand why Anders is so correct in the way to describe it. And so, more important, Anders, when are we going to see this car on the road?
Oof. So far, the restoration has taken, 2 years? It's probably going to be another two. So there's no point in rushing it. You know, I mean, I've got other stuff to drive in and But it'll get there. It'll get there.
Anders, let's speak a bit more about you. If I would say the word BMW in the following phrase in terms of Bravo, Mike, whiskey.
would phonetic that recall, alphabet.
Absolutely. Would that recall something of your one of your professions you did before you joined the car world?
Absolutely. Well, when I was very, very young, started working, I did dive into the car industry and worked there for a little bit. And then I ended up becoming a pilot, a commercial pilot of all things, something entirely different. Starting on small aircrafts as you do. Mm-hmm. I flew business jets for about 5 years, actually based out of, well, first I was in Cannes, then I was based out of Hamburg. And then I moved into airlines. I've lived in Hong Kong, flying airlines out there, and then moved to the UK. So, yeah, a lot of moving around, but all of it in the airline industry. 9 years of flying long haul, so literally flying around the world, all sorts of places, with the exception of Antarctica, as there's not a continent I haven't landed on.
Nice.
For 20 years, that was my, should we call it, my main profession. Mm-hmm. And yeah, loved it, enjoyed it. It was fun, it was cool.
I could imagine that you use some of your like professional travels as a commercial pilot also to all kinds of sourcing and research for cars, aren't you?
Absolutely. I mean, especially the last 9 years I was flying, because that was on long haul. So we went a lot of different places. And with such long flights, of course, you've got some downtime when you land somewhere, because there's restrictions on how many hours you can fly in one go. So you land somewhere, you have to stay there for a while. And of course, that's where my passion for cars sort of burnt through again. So I would always do my homework before we left. Where am I going? So what can I do there? Is there a classic car show on? Is there some motorsport going on? Or do I know someone here already? Perhaps I can meet up. So networking as well, just meeting people and seeing what they've got. And sourcing cars as well for me and for others. So I would also have this little side business of sourcing cars for clients. So if I was flying somewhere, I could go out and have a look at something for a client and give him a full report on what I saw and help him, you know, a bit of advice whether or not to buy and what the car was worth, what it would need doing afterwards and so forth. So yeah, I definitely used that industry to my advantage as well as a car nut, absolutely.
And what was, would you say there, the most surprising thing happened in sourcing a car?
I mean, again, so many years of doing this, there are many stories to be told.
we have enough time, no problem.
We could go on forever. I mean, while I was living in Hong Kong, I found a very, very early BMW, which I ended up buying myself, mm-hmm. a BMW 1602. So before it even became a 2002, it was one of the very first ones. And they were quite special because at this point it was, I mean, it wasn't the prototype as such, but with the amount of unique details on these early cars, it almost felt like a small production run of prototypes, and before it really got productionalized for the second year, the 66 cars have so many. I mean, that this is getting really, really nerdy, but there are so many small, unique details of them where the 66 stands out. And finding one today, of course, that is unmolested and still has all of that intact is pretty much impossible, because they were just, I mean, they were just ordinary drivers for a long time, and then they got restored and bits got swapped for newer bits. And but I found one in the very, very north of Sweden, just below the polar circle.
Yeah.
And I'd only seen it on pictures and, of course, spoken with the owner. It was a bit daunting. How do I do this? But I ended up buying it unseen, actually. And then I flew to get it. I had the chance to fly in to get it. And I flew from Hong Kong to Helsinki. Mm-hmm. From there, I caught a plane to Stockholm. And from there, I caught a smaller plane up to Luleå. So yeah, I think I spent close to 24 hours sat in an airplane to get there. And I saw the car. He opened up the garage door and the car was there. The anticipation, because I'd already bought it. I mean, if it had been horrible, I was sort of stuck with it.
Yeah.
So the anticipation was amazing. But it was all as he described and it was good. And that whole experience was just amazing. I mean, it was a dream for me to own a 66. And I finally found one with interesting history and all the rest. Yeah. So we, you know, after running around the car several times, taking in all the details, we had coffee and his wife had some cake and we went through all the paperwork and history. And then I jumped into the car, drove the car 2000, bearing in mind it's a 47-year-old car when I bought it. And I'd never seen it until a couple of hours before that. And I jumped into the car, drove it 2000 kilometers cross country, just back roads, no highways, down to Copenhagen. Took my time, 6 days, just enjoyed the drive, made a bit of a trip out of it, proper road trip, and put the car in a garage in Copenhagen and flew back to Hong Kong again. The things we do, eh? The things we do for classic cars.
What a trip. What a trip.
Absolutely.
No, very nice. But let's jump on. So that's very, like, super interesting. Thank you for sharing this as well. Like, telling us the stories, how you can connect your profession with your hobby. I think it's always a nice story. Also, maybe inspiring for other airline pilots who have the same deal. So if you listen in, Anders can tell you all the tricks, what to do in preparing your car-related trip. But then, okay, flying was then done for 20 years, I think a long time, seeing the world around. You would like to become more settled down in Denmark, I assume. And then there was a car museum part in your biography.
That's right.
Tell us more about this, please.
It was my chance to go full-time back into the car industry at that point. It's called the Horning Collection, H-A-A-N-I-N-G, Horning Collection. And it's a family-run business. Well, business. It is a business, but it doesn't feel like a business because it's driven on passion. The father, Eric, he's collected cars his whole life. So that was the base, if you will. But he collected, well, I say, but that sounds, it sounds like it's a negative. It's not. Basically, he collected everyday cars, normal cars, yesteryear's day-to-day runners, and had a vast collection of these. And based on this, his two sons wanted to create a special museum. Well, then I entered the equation and we started building this together.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very fluid process, which was interesting. We didn't sort of sit down with an architect and you know, and make a plan and say, this is what we're doing and stick to it. It was very, very fluid. And we changed directions multiple times on the way, which at times probably made it more challenging. But I think the end result was all the better for it because we didn't get sort of stuck in one vision of doing things. It was interesting. We bought in a lot of new cars as well to add to the existing collection. I mean, a lot of collections have a theme, you know, that it'll be just Ferraris or Italian sports cars, or it might be American convertibles from the 50s or whatever. Often the car collections end up having a theme. And quite early on, we decided that we didn't really want that. Well, I guess there is a theme, but the theme was we wanted to present the full automotive history within about 100 cars, which sounds ludicrous. It's obviously not really possible, but that was what we intended to try to do anyway. But in doing so, of course, you must choose those 100 cars very specifically. You can't just buy 100 cars that you think are fun. You need to really try to pinpoint, we want this car because it tells this story. So we, as an example, at one point we got to talking about, well, we didn't have a Renault 4. If we were going to represent the car industry as a whole, how could we not have something as important as a Renault 4? And the answer was, well, we already had a 2CV. So with 100 cars in the museum, we just could not afford giving two spots to something that close. So we had an early 2CV. And even down to choosing the 2CV, that was quite specific because we didn't just want any 2CV. We wanted a really early one, you know, with the, it was from 55. So it's when the canvas top continued right into the boot cover as well. So a lot of thought went into which 100 cars are we going to use to represent this automotive history in order to make it as broad as possible. It's 135 years of history starting in 1886, right? So 135 years of history across so many different countries with 100 cars. It's not easy. A lot of thought went into the presentation of it and the information that was with each car, the car descriptions and so forth. So it was good fun. It was a very, very challenging, but good fun.
I imagine it's a bit like being a kid in a candy store, having that as a daily job, I would say.
Absolutely. If at times sat in the office, it was a bit too challenging. All you needed to do was walk out into the hall and, you know, just go for a 5-minute walk amongst the cars and you were happy again and you new motivation was found.
Yeah.
It was, yeah, very much a candy shop.
And so whereabouts is the Horning Museum? Just tell us that if people want to visit.
It's just north of Copenhagen. Well, it is within Copenhagen, but it's north of the center of Copenhagen in a part of Copenhagen called Bagsvær.
So I would say that next time I'm coming over, we go together with the Horning Museum and we tell everyone. And we just can encourage everyone else going there and have a look, because I think it's just looking on the Instagram stuff, which I did in the preparation of that one, of that call, is really like super fantastic.
We'll go there in March for sure.
Yes, and we will report back, everyone. So if you have questions, just drop us a line. You will have an email in the comment box, and then you can drop us a line. Also, we encourage everyone to ask questions if they have, and we try to answer them in all detail possible. But now, just recently, a new chapter has been started with you. You start working with a renowned auction house, and your job title is car specialist.
That's right.
You definitely prove already that you're a car specialist. But what exactly does that mean, you're a car specialist with an auction house?
It's a good question. It's funny, though, because I joined RM Sotheby's, which is, of course, quite a big name. You can always measure it in different ways, but arguably we are at the moment the biggest and most successful classic car and collector car auction house in the world, I think. And joining them was probably initially also a little bit daunting for me. I thought, wow, you know, how did I manage this? That's amazing. I was really chuffed with myself. But one of my friends, he sat down and he said, but don't worry about it. You know, I mean, basically, you've been a car specialist your entire life. Now it's just a title, but you've been doing this your entire life anyway. So, you know, that was a bit of a sort of a calming moment from a friend. I thought, okay, I guess he's right. Yeah. But what does a car specialist do indeed? I mean, there's a lot to it. If you want to boil it right down to the bare essentials, I suppose that the simple answer is we source cars for auction. Mm-hmm. That's the very simple answer. But there's so much more to it than that.
Yeah.
We work with the collectors. I mean, most of these cars that we're talking about, I mean, again, it's broad, and we're quite happy to auction a car at, you know, at 25, 30,000 pounds as well, or euros or whatever. That's not an issue. But a very large portion of the cars we deal with, they are true and proper collector cars. So we work with these collectors to best curate their collection. It might not be a museum, but you're still curating a collection. And you advise them, you work with them. And that means sometimes getting them cars rather than auctioning away their cars, helping them get the next one they want for their collection. And that way, you build the relationship, which leads to of course, us existing as an auction house. We help the collectors.
I think that's quite a similar job than you've done with the car museum, just with a commercial background here, in a sense.
Essentially, yes, you could say so, yeah.
Right. And then if you're part of the car scene in Europe, it's not so familiar to sell a car at an auction. It's very like specific to the UK and the US. So please share with our audience, how does it work to sell a car on an auction?
I think you're very right. First of all, let me just say that. I think in the US, if you have a collector car of sorts, like something's a bit special, and you're thinking of getting rid of it, I think the default option is to go to an auction. UK, maybe not quite as much as in the US, but still, it's certainly an option. I think in Germany, which is a very big and very enthusiastic market for classic cars, and also Denmark, where I'm sat, Scandinavia as a whole, much less so. People, they will prefer generally to buy either from a dealer or a private deal. And auctioning is more something they see with artworks or furniture, not so much with classic cars. And of course, that's something we're working on. That's also why I'm here in Scandinavia, because I'm trying to create a bit more presence around this market. But the process as such, I mean, I'll always do my best to actually visit the person. I mean, I'm maybe a bit old-fashioned like that, but I like to actually visit the person, and I think it creates a better understanding between the two people, and also to see the car. And then we value the car. We talk about the history. We talk about, you know, what are its selling points. There could even be times where we agree that one or two points need improving, and it's worth the while to actually improve it before, so we might postpone it to a later auction. So there's also a lot of advice given. It's not just a hard, cold sale. There's a lot of advice in it as well.
Yeah.
And eventually we hopefully agree on what the market value is. That's where we, of course, we rely on all the experience we have in RM Sotheby's, and we can come across and give good, sound advice there. What's a realistic price to get? Because frankly, looking at mobile.de is not necessarily going to give you a realistic price of what it's worth. But if you look at what they have sold at previously in auctions over the past year or two, well, that will give you a realistic price. And from there, then we as an auctioning company, we have a research department. So we dig into that specific car's history and make sure that we present its history best possible. We get professional photography and we market the car, and then we bring the car to auction. Well, and before that, I should say, we also decide whether we want the car on a live auction, a traditional live auction, or with online auctions, which have now become a big thing, of course, after COVID.
Yeah. You know, there's always this fear if you join an auction that you do raise your hands on the uncertain moment, maybe greeting someone in the room or like tickle your nose, and you have the feeling that the auctioneer on the block is taking your auction. Has that ever happened in an auction you visited?
You sneeze and you buy a $1 million Ferrari. Yeah. Yeah, it's to be honest, it's the standing joke within the industry, isn't it? I mean, realistically, no, that would never happen. There is, first of all, it's not in the interest of the auctioneer or the auction house either to commit someone to buying something they don't want. And there is, you know, there's a special way of bidding, and it's not sneezing. So, but I have experienced one auctioneer who did make that joke as he was auctioning away a car, and a lady did, I think she did sneeze, or I don't know, or scratch her nose, and he did make the joke actually that oh we've got another bid, and she panicked, and he of course started laughing. It was a bit of a moment.
Great. For those listening, never visited an auction, try to do so. So, you know, you will be very welcome. There's no arrogance in it. Everyone is welcome to join. Of course, there's limited space, so you need to buy an auction catalog. But I think this is a very nice experience to wander around the cars, look at the cars, and then even being present at an auction. I can only highly recommend it, because really you feel this electricity in the room when there's a multi-million dollar car on the block, or even more special, a car which surprises everyone, which has an estimate of 150 to 250, but there are two people, for non-specific reasons you would understand, will try to beat themselves in the auction, and it goes for $1 million, $1.2 million or something like this. So I think all this atmosphere is just fantastic. So
Absolutely.
I would love to encourage everyone who has the possibility, go there and have a watch.
I agree. I think the traditional old school live auctions, the atmosphere is special. I mean, I've been attending them, of course, on one side of the block for a long time, and then recently moved to the other side, if you will. But regardless of which side you're sitting on, it's a special place to be. There's a very special vibe at these places. And even if you're not going to buy, just go and watch.
Yeah.
You know, kick tires and watch, and it's good fun.
And good conversations always.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Anders, you live in one of the most beautiful countries in Europe, which is Denmark. What is the number one route from A to B to enjoy Denmark the best way, driving a car or motorcycle?
Oh, number one route, A to B. See, you're right. Denmark is beautiful, but I'm challenged on that because I like driving in mountains, and there's not a whole lot of those in Denmark. But I will say, there's two areas that stand out for me. There's an area called Djursland, which is on the east coast of Jutland, just above Aarhus, our second largest city. And Djursland is just a fabulous place to get lost. Not necessarily go from A to B, but just no time schedule. You and your car, just go out there and get lost. And it's beautiful. There are amazing roads, beautiful scenery, stunning. A second place I like is the south coast of Fyn, the, if you will, the second largest island next to Zealand. The south coast of Fyn is another place that's beautiful. Just following the coastal road down there is amazing. It's stunning. Absolutely stunning. Those would be the two that I prefer in Denmark.
Perfect. Thank you very much. I think we will add some links on Google Maps. Maybe you can help with that.
Absolutely.
That you create a little map with some pinpoints.
Yep.
And you will see this in our link box below the podcast. Anders, mange tak. It has been fantastic.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it, Philip.
Thank you for listening to what Anders told us about the Danish car culture and his moving life between places, which was very incredible and interesting. And as we said, send us information, tips, comments, negative, best, positive, and that we will work on that one. So, Anders, thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.